The Blackshaw Art Hour.
Ooh, that's a tasty treat.
Hello, everyone. You're very well trained. You're already making spooky noises. Any advances on the ooze? When it's not fireworks night, guys. Hello, I'm Ellie. I'm the director of Blackshaw Theatre. We have put together this wonderful evening for you with the help of some incredible performers and writers who you're going to be seeing this evening. Is everyone going to give them a little woo? And now we're in game show territory. This is excellent. We're going to cover the full gamut this evening. Now, I hope everyone's packed a spare pair of pants. Yes? Yeah, always. Dirty stop out, okay. We're going to start off the evening with a little reveal of some props that I've brought along with me. I know, right? They're in my pocket. Now, does anyone want to make a guess at what it might be? Bearing in mind we're at a scare slam for scary things. Teeth. No, but I did discover some on my mum's bedside table once, and that was disturbing. I'm just going to give you a little story for every suggestion you make. Any other suggestions?
Severed finger.
No. I recently read on BuzzFeed that you can make food that looks like a severed finger out of a hot dog. Any advances?
Ectoplasm.
I think the most recent Ghostbusters was the best of the lot. Okay. Those near enough might be able to see these already. That's the sound of a man who's seen these before. These are tiny dolls. Tiny little dolls with little moving arms. My gran's downsized recently. Woo! And these are one of the many treasured possessions she's decided to part with. This one appears to be wearing some kind of swimming cap. Woo! There is another one, which I can tell you a story about later. So here are the three. Two in green swimming caps. Woo! One with weird cherub curls. Does anyone want to look at these closer? I'll do a showing later. That's fine, it's fine, still attached. Woo! These are apparently over 100 years old and 100% cursed. Again, I will tell you the story later. So that was just a little warm-up exercise for you all. Gonna put them back to bed now. Night-night time. Back in the old pocket. I'll be dead by morning. So, first up, we have got The Scratch. Now, Chris, the writer, is the co-producer and director of Hermetic Arts, whose show, Bad, brackets, bothered about Dungeons and Dragons, is at the London Horror Festival at the end of the month. So this is going to be a test of whether you want to go see that show. No pressure, Chris.
She first noticed The Scratch on Monday morning. She was sure it hadn't been there Sunday night because she remembered having difficulty with the clasp on her watch and would have noticed it then. She assumed it must have been self-inflicted, for though her nails were kept reasonably short, there was certainly enough length to cause the damage, maybe during a nightmare she didn't remember having, or maybe for no reason at all. And maybe if it had been a deeper or bloodier cut, or if it was causing her pain, then she would have expended more mental energy on the mystery. But it was Monday, and her head was filled with the anxieties that preoccupied her every Monday of going back to that job in that office with that man. The train journey into work felt, as always, like a death row walk to the executioner's needle, desperately hoping that, as the last minutes of life tick away, there'll be some last-minute reprieve, a lawyer bursting in, brandishing a stay of execution from the judge. You do not need to go into work today. You do not need to endure him. And she'd be embarrassed comparing someone about to lose their life to her own infinitely more minor problems, but at least a death row inmate is put out of their misery, she thought. And she was embarrassed for that too, but she thought it anyway. Arriving at the office, she knew straight away that something was wrong. Carl on reception was trying to perform his professional smile, but it was forced and joyless. What is it? She asked. What's happened? Carl flicked his eyes to the doorway, then leaned in towards her. Annie's quit, he said. Immediately, the atmosphere of unease made sense. Annie had been the last stand against the man who made her, who made all of their lives a living hell. She had armor that would not crack, no matter how much pressure was applied. His tempers, his irrationality, his bullying could never permeate Annie's cool carapace. Or if it did, it never showed. Without Annie on the team, there was nothing to protect them. By lunchtime, the scratch was twice as long, and now the skin around it was beginning to bruise. After work, she joined Carl, Moira, and Gina for a drink. They tried calling Annie, but her phone was off. As the red wine flowed, Gina started muttering, "The guy's unhinged," she said. "What if we all quit, hmm? All of us. There's nothing he could do about it." The others nodded, and they agreed, and they knew that none of them were going to do it. Annie had been the strongest, so it stood to reason that she'd be the only one with the strength to break it. The bar called time, they split the bill, and as they got ready to go, Moira asked her, "What did you do to your wrist?" Tuesday was as bad as Monday. Wednesday, if anything, was worse. Thursday passed as if in a delirium, his shouting and raging so frequent now that nothing else seemed to exist. And so she found it impossible to muster the curiosity to ask herself why her arm now had a seam running up it, like a poorly finished injection molded mannequin. Friday arrived, a smiling prison warden at the exit to the weekend, handing you back your personal effects and wishing you well in the outside world. But as she sat on the train heading in, she felt something different, something she'd never felt before. Knowledge. As the death row inmate walks towards the executioner's needle, knowledge that there will be no last-minute reprieve. No stay, no waiver. She felt no embarrassment for drawing the analogy this time. She felt only a relief in the knowledge that it would all soon be over. Entering reception, she gave Carl a smile, an actual smile. He seemed shocked, but he didn't know what she knew. He didn't know the clock was ticking down. Moira and Gina seemed equally surprised to see her looking so buoyant, and a little of it even rubbed off on them. For the first half hour of the day, the three women shared coffee, gossip, even a few jokes. When he finally arrived, late and bristling with anger, she finally knew him for what he really was. Not a villain, not a nightmare, but a noise. Just a noise. When he berated her for some perceived error in her figures, the words washed over her, syllables lapping and overlapping like the sound of a sea. When he screamed at her for some other concocted flaw, she just heard music. His eyes bulged and face turned purple as he swore and abused her where she stood. The sound swelled and then, with the abruptness of a needle scratch, dropped to silence. And as his blood boiled, so hers began to leak from the crack that had opened up the side of her body. Her arms split and her watch dropped to the floor. From top to toe, she unhinged, unfurling like a cocoon that had stayed tightly closed for too long. Out of her skin and out of her misery, as he screamed white noise, she saw red. Thank you.
When I first read that piece, when it got sent in, the thing that I could just kept thinking about was when you pick at the bits at the side of your nail and you pull a bit too far. Has anyone else done that? Now you all feel good. We're in the happy position of having a very full house, so I'm going to ask a few performers if you wouldn't mind grabbing a cushion and sitting on the stairs, because we're all about hashtag glamour. the cushions are just over there. And then photographer, who arrived late, let's do a little boo for him. Boo. No, bigger boo for the trains. Boo! Oh, that was... You weren't interested in booing on trains there. You just wanted to boo him. I know what you're all like. So... He'll be... He'll be fine. Okay, back to the scary. Ooh. See, this is the thing. I always want to make jokes, but really I've got to keep you in the zone. Ooh. Next up, I don't know why I bothered trying to get you in the zone, because this, I feel like this one's probably going to be funny. This is the Fatberg of Whitechapel. by Rhys Connolly. Now, I unfortunately have just got it in my head that I need to call Rhys Fatberg from now on. He seems fine with it. Rhys is a writer and theatre maker based in East London, originally from deepest, darkest Northumberland. He grew up next door to a Victorian cemetery in a household of one-eyed cats, dead farmers' ghosts, garden fairies, and a thing made of rags that lived in the attic. It probably explains why he loves scary stuff so much. He is involved in two productions at this year's Horror Festival, having written and co-directed Mr. Mushroom and written and directed The Stomaching, in which he also performs as a psychotic nun. You've come off really balanced here, Rhys. Mentally, I mean. So everybody, give it up for the Fatberg of Whitechapel. It's Rhys.
Hello. It's me, the filth and the fury, an accumulated mass-produced mess, a snowball from hell, an avalanche no less. Fuzzy, furry white with bristling, spreading mould and the heady stink of shite. I am the Fatberg of Whitechapel. Pleasure to finally meet, because I've been growing a while now under the city streets, fed by the gutters, the drains, a million gushing pipes. I am excrement, chip fat, toilet tissue, a billion stained wet wipes. Several thousand curries ejected in a hurry, bloody tampons, plastic bottles, a soda can, vomit and grease, old socks, a severed toe, the myriad ablutions of modern man. I am what you flush away and hope to forget, the waste, the unwanted, last night's regrets. But sewage never forgets. Down here, everything floats, and sometimes it sticks, comes together, gossips, bloats, and monsters are born. A dozen buses heavy, two football pitches long, I heave, I throb, ever growing, impossibly strong, spreading and steaming, suffocating rats as I stretch, adding their sweet disease and salty proteins to the rest. Occasionally, I belch, and somewhere near Aldgate East, a manhole cover quivers, sending shivers down the spine, putting chatters in the teeth of passers-by who fear without knowing what will always lie beneath. And a smile cracks out across my vast mottled gums. But my guts, they're aching, which could still be the condom, still floppy with lukewarm cum, always hard to digest, latex. But it's not that, it's the hunger. This hunger, it's a constant, old as time itself. I want, need more of what you offer, that infinite wealth of cooking oil, pubic shavings, clipped toenails, bleach, pet goldfish, battery acid, dirty shower water. Each and every one will sink and fold into my infinite rolls, building up the beast. But even beasts can be hunted. To some, their prize is game. A danger to society. It's always the same bloody old shit I hear and read in soggy, oozing newsprint about pollution and bad plumbing. Such a crying shame that you mistake me for what I'm not. Some unthinking, faceless clot in the arteries of London. And you'll have men come down with hammers, drills, chisels and flashlights on their heads. Knights in hazmat suits and gas masks come to clean me dead, to poke and prod and chop to bits. It's true. It's what I read, what Sadiq himself has said. Page 13, Evening Standard, only yesterday. Thank you, coincidentally, to whoever flushed that my way. Typical cowardly apes. So the time has come for the return, the regurgitation, the mother of all splashbacks. You send a team to kill me, I'll soon stop them in their tracks. I'll pull them into my popping skin, dissolving beyond doubt, crushing ribs beneath hardened fat till all the juicy bits come spilling out. Then I'll start moving down the waterway, spreading wherever the sewers go, sending long thrashing tentacles out from Bethnal Green to Pimlico, one for every pipe and drain, every plug hole toilet bath, every council flat and townhouse, every office and greasy calf, every restroom and urinal, every bar and shopping mall, every supermarket, school and theatre. I'll aim to hit them all. I'll crawl up past your U-bend, slither out across the floor, slip over your kitchen tiles, carpet, searching, sensing more and more and more the telltale sign of your breathing within a safe warm bed. It's here I'll do my dirtiest work as I wrap myself round your head, pushing my moist, muddy growths down into your sleeping gullet, reaching into lungs, livers, bellies and bottom bits, a slow, surefire bullet. Cleaning you out like a chimney sweep might, hoovering up nice meaty chunks, rinsing your bowels for hours and hours with each impassioned dunk. And before you even try, hang up the phone. Even Dynarod can't save you now. I'll erupt in Buckingham Palace from that most royal of thrones, and in Downing Street, just as every other street, I'll come and pick some bones and forcibly donate some organs. Well, this is what you get when you fucking compare me to Piers Morgan. I'm turning the city shitty, staying out all night, painting the town brown. London digested in a single night. That's all it's gonna take, but it's only stage one of all of the fun I've got planned to make the earth quake. I'll climb to the top of the BT Tower, and whilst I'm there, I'll compose my ultimate thought shower, putting the shout out all across the world, a psychic war cry, a call to power to all my fellow fatbergs from Washington to Dubai, Nigeria to Transylvania, Bombay to Saint-Tropez, Greece to Nice to Tunisia, Tokyo to downtown LA, from New York to County Cork, I'll urge my siblings to rise and seize the means of production. Let us all unite and mobilize so we can brutalize and colonize to claim our ultimate prize, a global conquest soaked in sewage. A new age, the next page of Earth's dominant species with the universe in our sights. So muse upon this, if you might, as you evacuate your bowels later tonight or tomorrow morning or the day after that, and recognize whatever you flush, whatever you've just shat out is destined for such greatness, of that you can bet. Remember what I said, sewers never forget, down here amongst the tissues, the rubbish, grease, oil, and poo. A guilty secret or two, the monsters are growing, and they're coming for you.
Anyone else feeling peckish? Up next, we have got Murder of Crows by Ed Hartland at Stack 10 Theatre. Stack 10 Theatre have returned to the Scare Slam, and they're very welcome, to bring you more tales from Chiswick, the home of horror, and, I have it on good authority, the gateway to hell.
It's said that in your time of dying, you will hear a soft beating of wings, signalling the coming of Azrael, the angel of death. When I was 13, I kicked a crow to death. I didn't mean to, I'm not proud of it, but you can't take that kind of thing back. I was young and stupid and hungover and stupid, and I was walking from my parents' house to the corner shop on Queen's Road, and I was desperate for something, anything, to dull the roiling in my stomach and the vice tightening around my brain. And that crow followed me the entire way. I swear to you, it followed me, cawing every step of the way. Now, my head felt like someone had embedded shards of glass in it, and every step was shuddering up my body, pulsing white pain. And this crow wouldn't shut up. The night before had been bad. I had drunk too much, taken too much, fought too much. I felt like a full English of shit. And this crow, the cawing, the bloody cawing, it ripped through my skull. It shredded strips from my brain. I couldn't hack it anymore, so I turned around and told it to fuck off. It just looked at me. It didn't move away, flapping its wings in panic. It just looked at me. Stared back at me with those eyes, those fucking eyes, black as pitch, black as cancer. The eternal nevermore hereafter. So I drew back my foot, and it connected with the crow's head, twisting it like it was doing some sort of double take or something, like I'd taken it by surprise, and then I drew it back again, and I'm kicking it again and again and again and again, and then I'm stamping on it. I'm just fucking stamping, and I felt the moment that its tiny skull gave way, and I'm screaming at myself to stop, but I can't. My foot is going down like a piston, and the feathers, and then they're matted and thick and flooded with blood. Like I say, I'm not proud of it. But I forgot about it. Did my best to forget about it until today. I'm walking from work to the bus stop, and I see them, two of them, crows, sat on top the bus shelter like silent sentinels, watching as I approach. I slowed down and they looked at each other. They turned their heads and looked at each other as if to say, him. So I crossed over the road, decided to walk home instead through the pissing rain and the gathering thunder clouds, bruised purple and full of storm. And by the time I reached Queen's Road and Green Street, The thunder sounded like distant artillery promising some fuck-off bombardment to come, and under that rumbling, I could hear them. I thought at first I was imagining it, but then I saw the tree. It's an old oak tree at the point where the two roads meet, gnarled and bunched and looming over the place like a monstrous arthritic hand plunged out of the earth. And on every bough and branch, every inch of wood flesh that they could sink talon into, sat a crow. The oak tree had shed its leaves, and in their place oily black crows had sprung, beaks chattering, wings writhing, and every single fucking one of them cawing. I stopped dead and they fell silent. And the sun setting behind me, and the final queasy red rays are bleeding over the murder in the tree. Grave silent and preternaturally still. How I got from there to my front door, I don't know. Every step of the way, watched by this murder, and I'm at my front door, and I go into my pocket for my keys, fumble them out, try to get them into the lock, and fuck! A dagger of bone and skin plunges into the back of my hand, and a crow wheels away, landing on my gatepost. I look at my hand, and it's like I've dipped it in paint. Spaghetti strands of tendon and pale flashes of bone glimpsing out from the moor, and this crow, this attacker, is sat there with my blood dripping from the tip of its beak. And in the darkling light, it could have been that crow from all those years ago come back, a revenant. I let myself into my house, locked the door. Storm took the power out. I've been sat in the dark for hours, years, waiting, listening to that murder outside, working themselves up into a frenzy, waiting for the moment that they'll attack, smash their bodies into the windows, listen to the glass crack, break, shatter, and they flood in, a swarm of beaks and claws to rip and shred and tear and plunge and stab. And see, crows don't forget. They can remember faces and hold grudges. And every ill deed deserves a reckoning. It's said that in your time of dying, you'll hear the soft beat of wings, signaling the approach of Azrael, the angel of death. I can hear it. Thank you very much.
So we've learned two very important lessons so far this evening. The two things that don't forget, fatbergs and crows. That's important, genuinely. I hope you've all written it down. Now, I'm performing the next piece. Very exciting. Oh, thanks, guys. This is The Watching Eye. It's been written by Dan Weatherer. For anyone who can't hear that, that's the hissing of a geriatric smoke machine. It's incontinent, so we'll do that at points. This is The Watching Eye by Dan Weatherer, an award-winning Staffordshire-based author and playwright, author of four collections, two novels, an upcoming novella on Dr. Crippen, and a book of plays due in 2018. You can visit danweatherer.com for more details. What a man. Crikey. The Watching Eye. Who could possibly have imagined that Wayside Cottage, a building that appeared so appealing in passing, with its ivy-covered walls, quaint thatched roof and rose-filled garden, could harbour evil within its walls? Pity then Tom and Angela, who had the misfortune to call Wayside Cottage home. The young couple, tired of city life, had poured their life savings into securing the property. Less than a year after purchase, Wayside Cottage would be reduced to rubble. They enjoyed the first few weeks of life in their new home. All seemed well, all seemed normal. Months passed, and the influence of Wayside Cottage began to take its toll. Tom became reclusive
and seldom left his home office. Angela had no time to be concerned for him. She had worries of her own. There was the kitchen cockroach infestation. She'd seen them scatter whenever she entered the room, and although she searched, she could find no trace of them afterwards. And then there was the bathroom mirror. It had begun to talk to her. And although at first the conversations were one-sided, as in it would talk and she would listen, lately she caught herself answering back, discussing the plight of her marriage. Surprisingly, the mirror understood. It had even offered a few novel suggestions as to how to deal with her increasingly reclusive husband. Still, it was only a piece of reflective glass. What did it know? Besides which, some of the mirror's suggestions were a little drastic, and this had led to several heated exchanges between she and it. Although the mirror insisted, Angela just wasn't in the right place to agree to that particular course of action. At least not yet. Almost on cue, she heard the mirror calling to her. Perhaps now was the time, after all. The soft knocking startled Tom. Yes, what is it? His voice was hoarse from lack of use. You know never to disturb me when I'm working. Angela opened the door and stepped into the cramped office. Tom didn't turn to acknowledge her. She raised the fire poke above her head and brought it crashing down onto the top of Tom's skull. There followed a wet, popping sound as blood and brain tissue started to escape the wound. With one smooth movement, Angela wrenched Tom from his chair and he fell to the floor, the fire poke nestled deep inside the back of his head. Angela could hear the bathroom mirror howling with delight. She smiled and wiped a bloody hand across her brow. The mirror had been right all along. Angela, now waist deep in what was once the basement floor, wondered how long the mirror would insist that she kept digging. At a depth of 8 feet, she uncovered what could only be described as the outer membrane of something organic, yellow in colour and pulsing to a slow and definite beat. The mirror, now resting on Tom's torso at the side of the pit, ordered her to proceed carefully. As she continued to dig, she realised to her dismay that she was standing on top of a vast eyeball. An eyeball that followed her every move. The mirror, delighted at her find, urged her to continue, and dutifully she uncovered the eye. The screams emanating from Wayside Cottage entered their fifth hour before the small police force that had been alerted to them finally had the courage to enter the property. Having conducted a thorough search of the house, they entered the basement. All of their combined years of service could not have prepared the officers for the sight that greeted them. The floor had been completely dug out. The body of Tom lay in several bloody chunks around the edges of a vast pit. And as officers approached the lip of the pit, they saw Angela kneeling on top of a huge eyeball, screaming obscenities as she tore the flesh from her husband's left arm and smeared it over the surface of the eye. While in custody, Angela explained that the mirror had convinced her to murder and dismember her husband so she could offer him to the beast beneath the cottage. The mirror had promised her a long and happy life, one in which all of her desires would be met, so long as she carried out the plan to its exact instruction. But this was not to be. The decision to demolish Wayside Cottage and rebury the thing that lay beneath it was taken quickly. Angela was declared mentally unfit to stand for trial for murder and incarcerated in a secure institution for the mentally unstable. There lingers an atmosphere of menace where the cottage once stood. And although few in the village acknowledge the events that took place on that fateful day, all insist that none shall ever tread upon the soil that covers the watching eye, for fear of stirring what lies beneath. So I think the moral there is don't move to the countryside. And continuing in the theme of eyes, in fact, all of these last pieces are to do with eyes and watching, which is really creepy because I can see all your eyes right now.
The next piece is called Big Eyes by Liam Stewart George. Liam is a West London writer with a penchant for making dark children's stories just that little bit darker. When not focusing on the works of Roald Dahl, he flits between writing short stories and plays and is currently developing one of the latter, entitled Man Down. This is another moralistic tale about a little numpty who gets it all wrong. Just don't be a dick.
All right, sweetheart. The mating call of the cretin. I turn to see his piercing, smug eyes leering at me. Good evening, I offer frostily. You don't look old enough to be here. I'm not, I'm 14. A flicker behind his eyes as he scans me for signs of deception. A guffaw chokes itself free. Oh, very good. Drink? Yes. What would you like, sexy? Whatever you're having, numbnuts. Surprised they let you in wearing a hoodie. I'd imagine that's the least of their worries. Momentary bliss as the ignoramus turns his back on me. His less appealing front reappears with bounty in tow. He slides the glass over to me, gently fizzing. Glorious. Another bulging smile from him. To us, he gurgles. To you, I correct. And your breathtaking smile. The verbal diarrhea thickens. I'm not sure I can bear this one much longer. Carelessly, my bag tumbles from my hand. As expected, he is down like a shot, his nose practically grazing the floor as he curtsies to the rescue. His eyes lose me for a few seconds, and the wheel turns. Shall we finish these and get out of here? The thought innocently escapes my mouth. Absolutely. Bottoms up. Indeed. He raises his glass high, then guzzles it. Before he can help himself, I can't wait to play with that tight little pussy of yours. Romance and all that. Shall I grab us a cab? He remarks. Chivalry personified. No need. I already ordered one. Well, you are fast and loose. Rather playing fast and loose with my patience. Mercifully, the car pulls up and we clamber in. He whispers some sweet nothings in my ear, more nothing than sweet. And then the game changer. Through his ever-rising grin, he breathes into my ear. I put a little something in your drink to help you relax. Information. My eyes dart around the car. All doors locked, all windows shut. He is less than 3 feet away, meaning any attempt to escape would prove futile. Even if possible, the car is travelling at around 30 miles an hour. Jumping from the vehicle would result in significant injury or fatality. Driver is an elderly woman, powerless to intervene. Thank you, I whisper. He looks bemused. For what? A smile kisses the corner of my lips. For confirming that it was you who tried to spike my drink. Tried to. And then, almost simultaneously, realization floods his mind as the drug streams into his nerves. He grabs for the door handle. Locked. Grasps at the window. Shut. I see the haze begin to seep into his brain. Help. Driver. The words drip from his lips like lead. May I offer some suggestions if you are going to drug someone? I am ever thoughtful. Firstly, don't buy the same drink as your victim. Impossible to keep track of whose is whose. Secondly, do not take your eyes off that drink, even if to politely help out a poor damsel whose bag has ever so carelessly fallen from her hand. And finally, and this one was unfortunate, don't choose me. I slowly and carefully remove the carving knife from my bag. And then a chuckle. It's funny. You spoke so charmingly about playing with my anatomy. Now it looks like I'm going to be exploring yours. Then a gag in the mouth. We don't want anyone hearing your howls. His eyes begin to glaze. I better get to work. The little old lady turns around. Everything all right, dear? Yes, thank you, Granny. Back to mine with this one. If you don't mind, Granny. I begin to get to work on him. My, what a big penis he has. She mutters, glancing back. I pull my red hoodie up. Not for long.
So there you go. That was performed by Jessica, if anyone wants to meet her at the bar afterwards. The final official piece of the night, this is before I give you the little story about my dolls, is called The Watcher by Joseph Willis. Born in Sheffield, Joseph studied a master's in writing, directing and performance at the University of York before starting his own horror theatre collective, Dance Macabre Productions. His usual work can be categorised as bloody tongue-in-cheek, and his piece, The Watcher, is a psychological horror that taps into his irrational fear that people staring into space are usually doing anything but.
I just speak into the recorder. Which one? This one right here. Okay, I'll try and remember everything, but if I need to, yeah, okay. So we moved into this old house, and whilst it creaked and groaned as it settled in the cold night air, it was what we'd always wanted since we'd moved in together. That was until that Wednesday night at 2 a.m. when he visited. See, I'd got up in the middle of the night to go to the loo, and there he was, stood on the drive, this tall, pale man. I mean, I say man, he had all the features of one, yes, but they were all stretched, distorted, like pulled taut across his skull like a mask. Like the face that he had was one that he wore, not one that was his. And he had these eyes, these bulging eyes, and they were so dry, as if he hadn't been blinking, as if there was no need to. And all he seemed to do was watch and stare and watch and grin, this unfaltering grin. Like there was a little hooks in the corner of his mouth, pulling them into place. And all he did was just keep grinning the more I watched that devil smile beaming in the dark moonlight. I mean, at least he was far from the house, I thought. At least he was far enough that I could get to the door and lock it. I mean, of all the nights for Paul to forget to lock the door, it had to be this one. I had to move. I had to stop him. I mean, the only thing was, maybe he hadn't seen me, maybe I was safe. Maybe I could just creep down and he wouldn't notice. The images then began to flash through my mind. Him breaking in a sprint towards the door, his bony hands clasping around the doorframe as I failed to hold on, his eyes bulging as he pushed the door open and walked towards my little son's room. Me failing, me screaming as he just carried on, smiling, grinning. I had to stop him. I set off, but as I did, I fell into the light switch, knocking the lights on, and boom, like a giant signal, they came on. He'd obviously seen me now, and I looked, fear coursing through my veins, to see that he was gone. The door. I ran downstairs, screaming bloody murder as I did, in some hope, somehow, that he'd have run off. And to my surprise, he had. There was no trace of him, nothing, except this little doll on the front doorstep. I got rid of it, chucked it in the bin, and locked the door, and went to Paul, my husband, who, in his very supportive way, thought I was crazy. But I wasn't crazy, I wasn't. The next day when I came back from work, there's John, sitting with this doll in his hands. I get rid of it again, I take it to Skip nearby so that he can't get to it. But then the next day, there it is once again, in his hands. And each time that I take it away, drown, burn, or crush that damn thing, it's there, in his hands. And the more I try and take it away, the more attached he becomes to it, crying for days and days on end when I take it away until I give it back. So, when Paul told me that my obsession with the doll had to stop, it was either him or the doll. I forgot. I know it was stupid now, but I forgot. Of course I would. So, in the subsequent months, as my marriage slowly repaired itself and my obsession became a thing with the past, we started to do some DIY. It's the way to start a marriage back up. And so we started painting. I mean, John had got a bit older. He was getting bigger, so we thought we'd knock through his wall into the washroom and give him some more space. But when we knocked through, we didn't find the washroom. You see, there was this secret room in between. You get them sometimes in these old houses where the walls have been plastered over. And in there was a mattress, feces, and a pile of dolls. You see, what we thought was creaking and groaning in the middle of the night, it had been him, waiting and watching. I couldn't stay there for much longer after that, so we moved to the city where I thought it'd be safe. But one week in, I hear screaming like I've never heard before, and I run into John's room to find him pointing at this doll. And as he does, the doll starts giggling, and as it does, the laugh starts getting deeper and deeper, and then it starts growing. I hear bones crack, what was once paint becomes skin. What was once stumps becomes limbs, toes, hands, claws. And that's when I realized that those eyes, those doll's eyes, they were his eyes. And that smile, that painted on smile, that was his smile. And I froze. I froze as he giggled, as he learnt his skin once more, as he stood up to his full height, as he wrapped his bony hands around my little boy's neck, and as he jumped out of the window. See, I'm not crazy. I'm not. I don't care what Paul says. I didn't do it. I couldn't. I wouldn't. What you found, those tears and shreds of John in the woods, that wasn't me. That wasn't. It was him, you see. It was him. That devil smile beaming in the dark moonlight.
That was dark. On which note? Here comes the packet of fun. We know what's in the packet of fun. So, can I have a volunteer to come up and have the dolls in their hand? Anybody? Woo! Is literally no one brave enough to hold these dolls? I can see someone standing up. You look like you could fight these dolls. How do they feel?
Cold.
Yeah, even though they've been in my hot little pocket. So these dolls, as I said, were in my gran's house, and she apparently loved playing with them as a child. It was the war, so I mean there wasn't a lot in the way of toys. So my mother said to me, "Oh yeah, there's some bits that Gran doesn't want," and I thought, "Oh great, I've got some good stuff from her downsizing." Got me a new fancy trunk to use as a side table. Got some nice books. Got a really old print of the Lord of the Rings books. So, you know, some nice things. Got these. Nice isn't a word I would use, but it was more out of freakish curiosity than anything that I decided to keep hold of them. And I mean, my sisters all literally made these sorts of noises when they saw them. So I thought, I'll take them. They're antiques after all. So I keep them wrapped up in here so that they don't get broken. So I came home with them and I put them on my kitchen table and then I went to work. When I came back from work, I'm just going to demonstrate how I lie them down. I put them in a little tuck in here and then roll. And then the second one, just tuck in here and then roll. And then I put the other one in. Thank you, sir. You may sit down. And then roll. You will die tonight. So they're pretty firmly ensconced. And they're just there on the kitchen table. All the windows and doors are shut because I'm not there and I don't want to get burgled. That was the least of my worries. Came home, expecting they'd still be... Stop hissing! Expecting they'd still be on the table. What I found on the table was just the wrapping. One doll was under the table. One was, took me a while to find, on a chair tucked under the table. And the chair sits tight against the table when it's tucked in, so it couldn't have just rolled off and then onto the chair. And the other one was on the sofa. Now, I won't make up things and be like, oh, it was posed like it was watching telly and the remote was there. The one on the chair had a tiny plate and a knife and fork. That was not the case, but they were in three separate places in my house. I live alone. So I don't believe in ghosts and things. I'm sure maybe some people here do, but I can't find a logical reason for this. So if anyone has a science reason for this, come and chat to me afterwards and let me know said science, because you are a god of science. And the other thing I was just going to, because we've got time, the other thing I was going to let you know about, I did a couple of scary stories last time, so I've run out of my when I'm in an old house, weird stuff happens stories, but you can listen to our podcast and listen back. Episode 51 is last year's scare slam. But the other thing that happened to me recently is I was asleep in bed, again, live alone, asleep in my bed, and then I very distinctly felt, I do have a cat, so the cat came and lay on my legs while I was half asleep. And I was like, oh, that's nice. Can feel the warm weight of a cat on my legs. Very much there. And then I heard a clatter in the kitchen. And I was like, oh, it's just the cat. Then I thought, ooh, but cat is on legs. Clatter cannot be cat also. So I sort of sat up to brush the cat off my legs to go and see what happened in the kitchen. Nothing on my legs. Went to the kitchen. Cat's there with a sieve on the floor. So I was like, cat definitely in kitchen, not on bed. Went back to bed, laid down again, and I had the exact same sensation. This time I even felt the pad, pad, pad of paws, and then a cat sitting on my legs. So there you go. cat ghost. Thought I'd end on a cat ghost. If anyone wants to see the dolls, I'll have them with me all night. If anyone wants to die tonight, you can touch them. When they're out of my pocket, that'd be a bit weird otherwise. So a huge thank you again to all the contributors. Big round of applause, please. And the programs you've all been given have the information, but please do sign up to our mailing list, follow us on the Twitters, follow us on the Instagrams, follow us on the Facebooks. Subscribe to our podcast. It is stuff like this and also arts chats and film reviews, and it's every other week and I'm on it. So if you had a good time tonight, chances are you will like having that in your ears. It's the Blackshot Arts Hour and it's available on iTunes and other podcast providers, but who uses those? It's on iTunes. Thank you very much for coming. Have a lovely evening.
Treat yourself to something.
Subscribe to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on your generic podcast resource.
You deserve it.